Robert Meyer. Reverend Robert Meyer, would you tell me, please, where you were born and when?
June 5th, 1932, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
And your parents' full names?
Wayne C. Hartmeyer. I'm a junior, by the way.
Uh-huh. But,
and Marjorie Dorothy Morton Hartmeyer.
And what did your parents do?
My mother was a homemaker,
mm-hmm.
until my dad died in 1957 when she went back to work. My father worked for the DuPont Company as a paint salesperson. Not sort of like door to door or store to store, but out of the office.
Mm-hmm. And you attended school in Philadelphia?
Upper Darby High School.
And your college years?
Princeton University, 50 to 54. And then the Navy for 3 years, and then Union Theological Seminary in New York.
And you went directly from the Navy to Union?
Yes, I did.
And then what did you do after Union?
I had worked in East Harlem Protestant Parish as a minister to youth during my seminary days, and I worked in East Harlem after seminary at the Church of the Resurrection, which was one of the churches of the parish, and I was the youth minister.
Union is known for its emphasis in social concerns, and I've read that in one place that those courses and that emphasis was actually at Union, and I've also read that some of you went to New York School of Social Studies or something. Was all your experience at Union?
And I think
there's some
not the most important thing, but one of the most important things was that Union was in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of emphasis on urban ministry, and of course the 50s was and the early 60s was an era in which the Protestant churches were focusing on the city, and the East Harlem Protestant Parish was part of that sort of like ferment to get the churches rethinking their mission to the city and reprioritizing too.
Was there one, or were there more than one individuals at Union that particularly impressed you or
influenced you,
helped shape you more than others?
Lots of them. Robert McAfee Brown was there.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Meilenberg in Old Testament. But probably biblical studies, discovering Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and East Harlem were the main influences on me.
Mm-hmm. What brought you to California?
In the summer of 59, at seminary, I did my summer field work in the California Migrant Ministry in Santa Clara County. So I knew the migrant ministry. About a year and a half after we were in East Harlem, my wife was assaulted in an elevator with our daughter in her arms, at knife point. And it kind of, she didn't feel at home anymore. And I was young and stupid, and it took me quite a while to realize that, as a family, we weren't going to, make it there. So it was about the same time that Doug Still was leaving as director of the California Migrant Ministry to go to Chicago. And he basically came after me with help from the National Council of Churches and other people to try and persuade me to come to California to be his successor.
And he knew about you just from the 3 months that you were out here?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What did you do during those 3 months? It was a summer internship. What did they put, what were your experiences?
Well, there were a lot more farm workers, of course, in Santa Clara County at that time. A lot more prunes and peaches, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And a lot of labor camps. And it's, thinking back about the things you do when you're young, it's kind of silly. But anyway, my job was to sort of like work with the local churches to help them develop programs in these migrant camps and then help them think about, you know, what they were learning and seeing. And of course, I knew barely more than they did, but we learned together.
Help them develop a structure, though.
Right, right. And that was my first. I mean, there are plenty of migrant farm workers in Pennsylvania, but I really wasn't aware of it. That was my first consciousness of farm workers.
That brought you here in, did you say?
September of 61.
September of 61.
And we had three children at that time.
Wow.
Our youngest son was born here in California. And although Wayne is my real name, and C, I let people think, stands for Chris. It doesn't, but Chris is strictly a nickname.
Okay.
No one ever calls me anything else.
And you're not willing to disclose what the C is, stands for, huh?
Clyde.
Clyde. Okay.
So you did take over the reins of the migrant ministry when you arrived in 61?
Yes.
Immediately?
Immediately.
What kind of operation did you have to oversee, staff?
Yeah, it was, there was a very large summer program where we would bring anywhere from 40 to 60 college students and seminary students to California, train them, divide them up into teams, put them in labor camps or in rural fringe areas, and then oversee their work, and then evaluate at the middle of the summer and evaluate at the end of the summer and then send them back to college. And then we had certain year-round programs also that were, you know, like the Kings Tulare Migrant Ministry or the Kern County Farm Labor Ministry or the San Joaquin County Migrant Ministry, and a developing rural fringe ministry, which Doug Still had begun, which was like getting denominations to do something in the rural fringe areas of the San Joaquin Valley and the Imperial Valley, too. That was a year-round program, a mission church, and a neighborhood house, a community organization project, something that they funded and staffed, but we basically were like either a consultant or they gave us the supervision of the project. And it varied from, we had a lot of different things going on around the state, mostly in the San Joaquin Valley, but not exclusively. Mm-hmm. And I was traveling all the time.
Must have been a certain amount of, tension, stress. Here you come out here with three children, young family, you have another child, and then you're basically on the road.
Yeah. But my wife, I did not want to come to California. I mean, I just the whole thing felt strange to me. Yeah. Being an administrator, you know, in an office and not being right there in the parish, you know, all that was very difficult for me.
So you were adjusting on two fronts then, domestic.
So anyway, I came reluctantly, necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
My wife was just really happy to have a backyard. And of course, we lived in Culver City. The office was downtown LA. Culver City is just about as, I mean, if you have to pick a place in Southern California, it's kind of like Ventura County in terms of the ocean breeze.
Yeah.
The ocean's, you know, 5 miles away. And anyway,
at that time, I hadn't built
up. Plus, she's a very independent woman. And, you know, my coming home was sometimes more of a problem than my being gone. So. There's a new authority figure who was in the house. Anyway, but it was not easy. My being gone was not easy. As the years went on, not having very much money was, you know, not easy. But somehow we did it.
What was your relationship with the denominations and the people that were supporting the migrant ministry at the time? Was it pretty good?
Yeah, see, one of the wonders of history is that we did have, I mean, we were a much beloved and pretty much ignored, you know, mission of the church. But we were definitely a child of the church.
Mm-hmm.
But conference. It was ecumenical, but there was a Council of Churches in Southern California and a Council of Churches in Northern California, and a statewide migrant ministry made up of representatives of both councils, and that we were tied directly to the denominations by this California Migrant Ministry Commission. And we would, of course, report to the Council of Churches and report to the Northern California Council of Churches, and our relationship was basically good. And then in forming these rural fringe ministries, our relationship strengthened. I mean, you know, they got to know us, we got to know them. We worked very closely in setting up, say, the Goshen, where Jim went, you know, the Goshen Community Center project. Mm-hmm. We worked with Walter Press and Richard Norberg and then John Moyer from New York. And so we got to know each other very well. And actually, our relationship with a lot of local churches and a lot of local pastors was good. Local, I mean, you know, agricultural area. Because there were people who wanted to do something with farm workers, and we enabled them to do that. And the something was the traditional charitable service programs that you would kind of expect white, middle-class church people to do.
It never led to any sort of theological difficulty serving so many different, such a widely diverse group of churches and denominations. They never micromanaged, I guess, or looked that far.
No.
That's interesting.
The people who come together in sort of like an ecumenical mission project or action project, usually there are less differences among them than there are between them and other people in their own denominations. So when you do something, you tend to attract people who want to do it, and they tend to have like a basically similar theological framework. Not always the same. Some of our summer volunteers, some of our summer college kids were very fundamentalistic, right? Mm-hmm. And that we had a few little tensions with that, but not much. The real tensions developed around the Bracero program, and that was more between the migrant ministry and the growers, and then around our community organization projects when they did things that the local community, you know, didn't like.
Could you tell us a little more detail what you were doing in Kern and Tulare counties, and then, of course, about your first encounters with Chavez?
Okay, in Kern County, there were two projects. One was a mission church in Lamont, a Lutheran. It was a Lutheran Church in America, a mission church in Lamont, California, okay? And it was designed from the beginning to be a church that serves all people.
Well, when was that established?
Oh, Lord. I think it was established before I got there. So it must have been around 60, 59, 60, okay? And then the Friendship House, is that right? Yeah, Friendship House was a neighborhood house in South Bakersfield, which was the United Church of Christ project, also in place and in operation when I got there. And then in Kings and Tulare County, we had a joint migrant ministry, but also Goshen, and that was the United Church of Christ. And then we set up the Kings Tulare Community Development Project, something like that. Dave Havens and Jim Drake. Mm-hmm. That was centered in Porterville. And that developed its own little farm worker organization, which eventually affiliated with the National Farm Workers Association. Mm-hmm. And then we had a mission church in Mendota, which was Methodist, and that was like an outreach ministry to East Mendota. Mm-hmm. And then Dos Palos, one of the more interesting ones, was a Disciples of Christ project and community center and community organization project in the farm worker fringe of Dos Palos.
With Art Jenkins?
Art Jenkins, right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And Ben Fredicella, and they were kind of like a inside, outside.
Yeah. One of the things, it's interesting, you know, the valley is very segregated in the sense that you find almost pockets of blacks. You know, the so-called Golden West Side, Los Palos, you know,
East Mendota.
East Mendota, then part of Bakersfield. And it seems like those are some of the those points which you established projects. Now, was there anything, I mean, was that, to somebody who's born and raised in California, there's a tendency to say, well, in this country, race relationships tend to focus on the black and white. And only more recently do we talk about Latino and Asian.
Yeah. Well, I mean, was East Mendota, of course, became, or it was quite a mix.
Yeah, it was mixed. Yeah. In fact, even Golden West Side of Fresno, and there's... Yeah.
And
there's,
Porterville, of course, was primarily...
Primarily
Chicano. Chicano. I never thought about it that way, because we did, all in all, we had quite a mix, and of course, as time went on, more and more, I mean, fewer and fewer black farm workers, and more and more.
Yeah, the numbers diminished very...
Chicano farm workers. Well, after the cotton...
Yeah, when the cotton...
came in. Devastated the black working force.
Yeah, cotton and watermelon were the big things that I can remember seeing. Yeah. You know, we'd see big when I was a little kid. You know, buses coming out of these areas. And that's how we knew where these communities were. Either that, or when the high school football team showed up, and you knew where they were too.
So we had, we had these projects all over the place, as well as this summer. Migrant ministry program, which was traditional.
Yeah.
And pretty much everybody thought it was wonderful.
I'd like to back up a little bit, something I forgot to ask you. Would you tell me about when you met Dave Havens and Jim Gray?
Well, Jim, I guess, just graduated from Union Seminary and was headed to the Parks Ministry. But had heard about the migrant ministry, probably because I used to go back to Union every spring to recruit for summer, and sometimes for year-round. And so he just wanted to, before he made this final decision, he wanted to talk about other alternatives. So I met he and Susan. Oh, God, I don't know. It seems like it was Goshen, but it couldn't have been. But somewhere up the valley, and just told him what we had in mind.
So you kind of recruited him. He came and talked to you, and you reached an agreement.
He decided to come with us instead of with the Parks. Mm-hmm.
Remember when that was?
Oh, when that was?
Greg?
62?
Two.
Yeah, at least 62. Because almost right away he went to do some training with Caesar, who had already started, the National, he was organizing for the National Farm Workers Association. So it was probably summer 62.
Yeah, Caesar left CSO in 62.
Mm-hmm. Right.
March 31st, approximately.
And then Dave?
Isn't that interesting?
Soon thereafter.
I can't remember when it was that I met David.
You know how he happened to, what the circumstances were?
I guess we were looking for a successor to our King's Delirium Migrant Ministry staff person, who was Sandy Robbins. And David came out of the disciples, someone suggested his name.
Now, was Jim Drake already working in around Delano when Chavez arrived, or is the other way around?
The other way around.
But you did have your operations in place when you arrived. Did you have any contact before that with CSO?
Yeah. Doug Still, who was my predecessor, as the Migrant Ministry Director, and started many of these, the initiatives that led us eventually into Delano, just told me there were two people I had to meet. And they weren't bishops, and they weren't denominational executives. But among the first people I had to meet, these two were the most important that I had to meet, Fred and Caesar. So he left that with me.
Well, they were still organizing for CSO.
And they were in L.A. at the time. Mm-hmm. So I met them in a little cafe in East L.A. And I guess the purpose of the meeting was to sort of like feel each other out. I'm sure they were real curious as to who this. I'm sure, you know, I was a baby faced. I looked young as hell, I'm sure. I don't know what they thought, but my purpose was to meet them, but also to set up a time and a place for me to do some CSO training. Because Doug had set it up that through a grant from the Schwarzkopf Foundation that all migrant ministry staff spent time, you know, training with CSO, usually, you know, 6 weeks at a time. And they would just go with, most of them just went with Fred and Caesar as they did their work. That was no longer an option because they were settled in L.A. So I went up to Stockton where Dolores and Gilbert were and spent, you know, it was the fall of, it was a couple months after I got there. I spent about 6 weeks up in Stockton learning about the CSO.
In 61.
In 61.
Did you ever meet Alinsky?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I met Alinsky on my way west. No. On my way west to do an interview before we actually decided and moved. I guess Doug probably set it up for me to meet Alinsky in Chicago. And then met him in California, too, more than once.
Yeah. Because he did come out occasionally to supervise the training or check in on the training.
The evaluative sessions and...
Did you develop a relationship in 61, 62 with AFSC?
Probably.
David Berciaga, maybe?
Bard McAllister.
Bard McAllister?
Yeah, in the Visalia.
Yeah, he was the Visalia.
Yeah, it was, I think it was before David's time.
Yeah.
David at that time was like an active leader in the Bakersfield chapter of the CSO.
Yeah,
yes.
He was working with a plumbing supply company. Yeah. And
he was a president there for a couple of years about that time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So in my, other than the work I had in the migrant ministry and all the learning I had to do and all the denominations I had to find, you know, get to know and all that other stuff, so my primary relationship was with the CSO, going to their conventions, going to their board meetings. I was always welcome. And who knows, but I'm sure Caesar's mind was already, you know, on the day when farm workers would need friends.
Mm-hmm.
So let's cultivate friends.
Let's cultivate friends.
Well.
And I was at the convention in Calexico where the CSO decided not to take on farm labor organizing and which led to Caesar's resignation.
Mm-hmm. You, of course, were already becoming a friend of the farm workers in your own right without Caesar wasn't the only one that was a friend of the farm worker at the time.
No, I mean, actually our whole staff was like just, our staff was, when they were there, they loved these folks that they worked with. And
so
of course they had all the frustrations that any normal person would have, you know, like, why doesn't anything change?
Right. So, I mean, what I'm trying to establish here, you really have a coinciding of interest, and two people with similar interests coming together, or more, Fred. And what was your early relationship then with Gil and Dolores, since you trained with them? Was that an especially close relationship for the next several years then?
Yeah, I think more with Gil than with Dolores, but... And I don't know why. Maybe just because of the differences in the families or something. Yeah. But Gil, probably Gil took me more under his wing when I was in Stockton. Dolores was always like, choo, 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 here and there.
Well, Gil's a particularly amiable man, too.
Oh, absolutely. And like he was more there, and he was like more the, you know, my mentor while I was in the CSO, while I was up in Stockton.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that relationship continued for you then, right?
Yeah. I mean, from a distance, Gil ended up living where it was the family, near, you know, Hanford, maybe.
Hanford.
I think they were in Hanford.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when I would come through, or when I, you know, we stayed in touch. Oh, and Gil worked for us.
Yeah.
There came a point, you know, in our community development project in Tulare County, where we needed
it became more and more obvious that one, we were working two sides of the tracks, right? The church and the farm worker, or mm-hmm. the rural fringe. Mm-hmm. And it was obvious that one side was well organized and one side was not as well organized. So then we added Jim and Gil worked together on the farm worker organization. And David was sort of like the one in trying, you know, to work with the churches. Although David was a total maverick, so I mean, he was not a great choice for working with the churches, right?
Well, I was going
to
say,
if you wanted to choose someone to really angry, make piss off the churches, it'd be David Haynes.
From somebody who was grew up in the Midwest and United Church, a congregation became United Church of Christ. That's, you know, who supported these ministries. You would have, as a kid, I'd have a sense of missionaries out there. You know, when we see your efforts become more and more of an organizer. I'm curious, when you went to work or went to see Alinsky and then went up and trained with Gil and Dolores, did you think of using the organizing techniques to bring people into the church? Or did you think you were learning to use the organizing techniques to help the farm workers on a social economic level?
The latter. I don't think we ever... evangelization, bringing people into the church, was never a central, never central to our work. It was like service was central to our work. Trying to be helpful to people, you know, who had many, many problems, who were very, very poor and many, many problems. And of course, the more we tried to be helpful in that way, the more we realized that what we were doing was just like inadequate. And maybe even damaging.
How's that?
Oh, we were helping people in these rural areas feel good about, you know, this service work with farm workers without actually confronting, you know, the horrible injustice of it. And to some extent, ourselves, too. You know, like getting a lot of satisfaction out of being good people with farm workers, but without going to the root of the matter, which we were all participants in. It wasn't like we were some, I mean, cheap food was benefiting us all. And of course, in the rural areas, the fact that the farm worker kids weren't prepared to go to college was a benefit to the families whose kids did go to college, less competition. So like there was, everything about keeping people poor was beneficial to those in charge.
Well, but that notion of keeping people poor seems to me that you've got to, the folks you're talking about, the more stable, you know, the more stable church people that you were trying to link up to the fringe and the migrant, probably you had to convince them that there was that
they
people were
think
being
about
kept
that way. Clearly, they didn't,
and they didn't think people are being kept poor.
There were people with good hearts.
Good hearts. Yeah.
There were people with good hearts.
Yeah.
And they had never thought about their complicity in this system. Yeah.
Do you now, or looking back, have a sense of how the farm worker felt about the people with the good hearts?
My impression is, except for the most politicized among them, they were glad for the people with the good hearts. And I mean, the UFW organizers I've talked to who remember migrant ministry people, yeah, remember them.
Yeah.
So there was no resentment if people from a church in Fresno came out with a pickup full of food or clothes or something.
Yeah, but usually it was more organized. Like it was every week. The youth group would come and play volleyball, show movies, and you know, but sometimes English movies in English and give me a break. But I mean, you know, we tried everything. We tried everything. And some of it was more obviously inadequate than others. But I never kind of got to the point where I looked down on that era or those people or ourselves in that era. It was just part of a transition to a different day.
That's interesting. There's nothing in your experience, the collective, your church's experience, or that you read or learned in seminary? How did, you know, I've always thought, you know, say missionaries go to wherever, you know, some exotic place, they have a plan, you know, and they've talked to other missionaries, and now here's how you do it. But you came out here with no rule book. Eh?
Well, except that the rule book was in place in a way. I mean, these programs were in place. I inherited a lot. And we continued to do it. But we also continued to sort of like try other things.
Well, as
it, and then we got involved in the Becerra fight, which kind of like prepared us for controversy. I mean, it was like a new experience for most of us. People actually didn't like us. I mean, some of them were telling lies about us. And some of us wanted to, some of them wanted us not to be in existence anymore. I mean, that was a shocking. For the average white Protestant male, that was a shocking experience. But a necessary, we had to learn. Because, of course, it got a lot worse than that.
This is a bit of an aside, but I think it fits at a time period. Pablo Espinosa was in the Linnell labor camp and was in the rent strike.
Right.
And he said he was organized by Gil,
who was working with the with our community development project.
And Jim Drake and Dave Havens. That was
the summer of 64.
Summer 64.
Before the strike.
All right. I know it was before the strike.
Yeah. Okay. And Leroy was marched in that
yes,
we famous we, yeah, picture of he was brother,
coming, brother
Brother Gilbert.
Gilbert.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Much to Aloysius.
That's true. That's that was our that was our deal.
Yeah.
But see, there was some of those, that rent strike for one thing, but also the farm workers organization in Porterville kind of like basically took sides with a Chicano student that had been beaten up by a teacher. And that was kind of like the watershed event for that community development project. All of a sudden, the friendly white community, you know, got less friendly. I mean, how can you take the side of this, you know, this brutal child, you know, kid? Because, of course, the teacher is telling one story and the student is telling another story. And we raised the money for a lawyer for the family and, you know, just went after that teacher tooth and nail. And that was that was a big change for that project.
And I would assume that the rent strike had countywide repercussions. I actually haven't read any of the papers. But
then they went after back wages for some sugar beet workers. You know, slowly but surely it became obvious that this was, there was not going to be a lot of cooperative establishment support for this effort.
Do you know who and how they happened to pick the Linnell labor camp as a point of confrontation or
My memory is that they were about to raise rents.
Yes, they were.
That our folks were, you know, had contact with some of the families that lived there. And it came to their attention that they were raising rents, and then the organization decided to do something about it. That's my memory.
I was particularly taken by the way they conducted that, because they took their rent and put it into an escrow account so that the county couldn't say, well, you just quit paying rent and throw them out. So they had a...
Clever of us, huh?
Yeah, right. That's legitimate form to it.
Right. That's probably Jim's idea.
And the other intriguing thing is it's not the first one of the first or earliest rent strikes against a public landlord, rather than, you know, private landlords. You've always had these troubles, but this is a public housing, you know, authority through the county.
So well, sort of like looking back, I see all those wonderful events as kind of like preparation for the crunch that was coming.
Did any of these events, I know they, you know, you begin to generate a lot of animosity toward your group and yourselves, did they also serve to recruit some people? Did people come to you and volunteer, offer to help with it? Or was there just so much?
I'm sure, but I mean, that was more obvious after the grape strike than it was before the grape strike. But I'm sure
there was some of that, but mostly in mostly from the point of view of our friends in the San Joaquin Valley, it was kind of like a losing proposition starting in 63, 64. And in the Imperial Valley and the Riverside County area, there was like the Bracero Wish was more, and San Joaquin County. Those were the Bracero Wish was kind of like the watershed event. And when our friends went, down there.
When you went in 64 to make your report to the Council of Churches, how did, were you received there?
I think basically we did a very good job of bringing our Migrant Ministry Commission along and the Council of Churches as well.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, it was the civil rights era.
Yes.
We had that background that was a help to us. Mm-hmm. And we had urban church folks, bishops even, who had gone, mm-hmm. you know, to Selma. And, yeah. And they understood, you know, sort of like the difference between what happens locally and what's, you know, mm-hmm. what happens in the urban areas and mm-hmm. what. And the way church people look at things locally, even though they feel very strongly about them, they may have a kind of a jaundiced view of, you know, mm-hmm. of what's, what justice is in their own town. Mm-hmm. And who's hurt and who isn't hurt.
May have.
the famous statement by the Methodist minister of Delano, you know, he couldn't understand what's all this about. I mean, this is like a little United Nations here in Delano. Everybody's happy. We all live together. It's just wonderful here. And for him, it was wonderful. He just didn't know everything.
Do you have something at this point?
No, I just want to keep this going because our time is...
Okay. Then, well, we're chronologically,
we're up to 64, so...
We're up to 64, so... This is when you... began working more closely with Chavez, right?
Well, from 62 on, we were like...
Would you Jim talk about there. That relationship?
Yeah.
Between 62 and 65 and what you...
Yeah, I mean, like, when I was in the Valley, I would stop by, you know, and see Caesar if he was there, which he usually wasn't, or Helen and the kids, and just mm-hmm. check in. And Jim, of course, worked with him for a while, you know, in 62, and... We used our credit card for his little car, you know, because mm-hmm. he had a car, but he didn't have much gas. And mm-hmm. we hustled a mimeograph machine for them, which I think at that time was they were operating out of the house. And then Caesar would come to our retreat. Sometimes both Caesar and Helen would come to the retreats, but usually Caesar alone because of the kids, you know. And Caesar would come to our retreats, and then he would just bring us up to date and what was happening and if he needed something that he felt comfortable asking for, he would call me in L.A. or he'd have Jim call Jim. So we had this kind of working relationship that wasn't too close but was consistent and steady. And, you know, and we knew what he was doing. We knew what the plan was. We knew about the cards to get people to sign up for what they thought the minimum wage ought to be. And we knew his... What he was really aiming for was finding, you know, those few key people in every community of the San Joaquin Valley who would like, who would be willing to stand up when the, you know, when the hard times come. And
to what extent did that parallel your work or your own work parallel that work? I mean, were you developing community
probably. I don't remember this, but I must have like consulted with Caesar from time to time, or Fred, or both of them, like about what was happening in mm-hmm. Dos Palos and what was happening, you know, in yeah. Kern County, and mm-hmm. I mean Tulare mm-hmm. County, and then down in the Imperial yeah. Valley, and anyway,
yeah.
I was probably learning from them because of the controversy that was developing around some of our projects, mm-hmm. as well as, you know, learning about what they were doing. Mm-hmm. But my memory is that we were mostly just staying really close and watching and knowing what Caesar was doing and believing more and more and more and more believing in it. We probably, most of us, believed in it from day one just because we had gotten knowing.
As we begin to get closer and closer to the grape strike, it seems to me there was a growing coalition in Delano. Is that your perception?
coalition?
Well, a lot of people, a lot of organizations who had been working with farm workers for the last 4 or 5 years or longer, CSO, AFSC, Migrant Ministry, and others who essentially shared goals. And those people came together in Delano at some point, sort of under the umbrella of the what became the UFW.
I don't remember that.
Yeah.
I remember something called the Conference on Families Who Follow the Crops.
That
Florence Wyckoff, who lived over in Watsonville, would pull together, you know, these annual gatherings, and like all the groups would participate. And and I remember the big thing was we have to get farm workers to participate too. But of course, it was always like hand-picked farm workers, people who we already knew. So it was kind of like a.
But you were trying to do something. You were trying to do something different, though, because you know you talk about a community organization process rather than an annual conference or something
like
that.
This was peripheral. This annual conference, we cooperated with it because there were so many good people involved, and it was like something that Dean Collins had done and Doug had done, and I should do, you know. But it was definitely peripheral to our main work, and eventually it became like a distraction. Because, you know, we just didn't have the time for it. There was a lot of things we ended up not having time for, you know, after the strike began. But I don't think there was any
let's try it from
organized coalition.
No, I didn't mean an organized coalition.
There were lots of different friends around.
No, let's try it from maybe another. See, because we're looking at a situation where there's a lot of small communities. I mean, they're small. They're even smaller in that time. If you have, you know, the National Farm Workers Association, as you were saying, looking for those key people, those people who will be the points, the catalysts. In your efforts in community organization, aren't you, in a way, looking for the same thing, for catalysts in these little communities?
Yes, we are.
And they're not going to be a lot in a little town. I mean, even in big towns, there aren't a lot of people.
But parallel to what Caesar was doing.
Was there...
Not joined.
Yeah.
The only time the efforts joined was when the Farm Workers Organization in the Porterville area actually joined the National Farm Workers Association. And it was not easy. It was controversial. The vote was very close. Because the farmer organization leaders wanted to be their leaders. They didn't want to, you know, be
subsumed
or
be part of
someone else's organization.
Well, that's part of what I'm curious about is, let me come at it a little sideways. In the interview with David Bursiaga, he was talking about the number of people that worked with Chavez that were working independently of him but then supported him and it came into the union, and he essentially said that, you know, we really sat down and decided, look, we all share in the same ideas. It's not like Chavez has a bunch of new ideas that the rest of us haven't had or goals, but he's an extremely hard worker. We'll throw in with him. And there was sort of a consensus of let him be the leader, or we'll make him the leader, or we'll even promote him as the leader. And a sense of how people react to having one individual that they could almost build a myth around.
Interesting.
And that was...
This is looking back, right?
That was, you know...
I never viewed it that way. I never viewed it that way at all.
Well, I've noticed you've been saying that you were learning for Chavez. I'm guessing that was probably more of a two-way street than your...
No. I'm not being falsely humble here.
What was your impression of him at that time in the, you know, say, 60... Well, between 62, 63, 64...
Yeah. Well, Caesar was, you know, he was self-educated, right? CSO trained, had become kind of a Gandhi reader, you know, and somewhat of an expert even. read labor history all the time, had absorbed all the information he could get about previous farm labor strikes and what had happened to them and farm labor organizations, right? It was like this was the moment and this was the man. I mean, he was like, he had prepared himself for this time. Mm-hmm. Now, I know he had some uncertainty about whether this would work, whether people would pay dues, whether enough people would pay dues, that they would, you know, they'd be able to survive. I know he had uncertainty about that. But from our point of view, he had clear direction. There was no doubt about his commitment, you know. And he had the experience and the knowledge to go with this clear direction. So we were mostly grateful that someone was taking this on, that we believed in, and was doing it from the grassroots up instead of from AFL-CIO down, and had the sort of like the determination to carry it through, and believe that this was like his life work. So we were just very, very grateful, happy that Caesar was doing this, and we weren't thinking about what was coming at all. We were just kind of like supporting him in any way we could and learning more about what he was doing and why he was doing it. So it was one of the reasons why the relationship worked so well over the years. We were just really clear that Caesar and the workers who had joined him were sort of like leading the way, and had made the life commitments that would allow them to lead the way, right? Many of which we had not made. And so we were in a position, that wonderful, unique, rare position where people who were not farm workers, you know, people who were not poor, could genuinely support an indigenous social movement and know that their support was valuable. And it was just like, it's just a wonderful. And we just, Margaret Mystery just happened to be there. I mean, the Catholic Church was there, but it wasn't there in an organized way. It wasn't there in a way that was focused on farm workers. It wasn't there in a way that had enabled this relationship, a relationship to develop. Individual priests, yes, but organized church, it was sort of like us.
Well, even the Spanish-speaking mission band really was a traveling, sacramental dispensing organization. I mean, it started... there were some of the people involved in that, and individual pastors would start moving away from that. But you know, when you look at that, it really didn't get away from that. I mean, they wanted to roll into town to hear the confessions, to give communion, to do the marriages that hadn't been done. I mean, it was really, it's kind of like about a 300-year-old model from in the Southwest.
Could be. I never actually thought about that. But what I did know was that the church. So, you know, we were a child of the church, and they had put us there to work with farm workers and supported us in working with farm workers, right? Even though most of the hierarchy in those valleys, you know, were not too sure about what we were doing, and eventually were very, you know, very sure what we were doing was wrong, right? But it was sort of like too late by then. Whereas a local priest was under a local bishop who had much more control over that priest and his church than anybody had over us. We had this amazing freedom.
Did you develop any strategies for dealing with the local pastors and church leaders?
Are we at the strike now? Because there was a big change, right?
Well,
You we know had, better. Pre-strike, we had a strategy of pulling as many local church people as we could into mm-hmm. what was being done, often by them. Mm-hmm. And we were just sort of like the coordinators or consultants. Mm-hmm. Or, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and then we continued that after the strike, but then, of course, it became harder and harder because mm-hmm. many local churches didn't want us in their churches. It was too dangerous for them, mm-hmm. or too controversial, or potentially controversial. Mm-hmm. So the relationship between us and these local migrant ministries just began to change, you know, quickly after the strike hit, and after it became visible that we were there on the picket line, you know, with Caesar, and that we were supporting visibly, verbally, you know, with food and resources, we were supporting the strike. After that became visible, then everything, you know, everything changed for us in those rural valleys, every rural valley, but especially the San Joaquin.
Did you go to the valley as soon as
we had a strategy?
AWOC went on strike?
First of all, Yeah. Well, Jim was there. Dave was, you know, there.
No,
soon.
I mean you personally. Did
Me
you,
personally, I came. It was like a Thursday night. I think it was a Thursday night meeting where they voted to go on to join the strike, and that was like the 16th of September, maybe.
Yes.
That Sunday, Caesar asked me to come and sort of like mediate a deal between him and Al Green
mm-hmm.
about how the two unions would work together.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, typical yeah. Caesar, right? I mean, he picks his buddy to be the mediator.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Could you?
And Al Green yeah. was, for some reason, yeah. willing
yeah,
I was gonna say, to accept. As the mediator.
Had you had contact with Al Green? You were talking about, you made reference to AFL top-down. I mean, that's Al Green, you know.
No, and we would go to their strikes, too, when they happened, and, yeah. and we supported what the AWOC was doing, but we just had a different feeling for it.
What was that meeting like? Mediating between Green and Chavez when, I'm sure,
it was
a lot of control. And
it was awkward. But I think my memory is that what Caesar was proposing, and he was clearly the proposer, was reasonable. And Al Green was willing to, you know, go along with it.
And there wasn't any sense on his part or from AWOC that, look, you guys are supporting our strike, you're not taking...
There was definitely definite jealousies.
Mm-hmm.
But there was also a recognition of who the majority of the workforce was.
And
like a Filipino strike could not win
mm-hmm.
if the Mexicans were going to work.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't hear the like the Camacho speech and the stuff the night they decided to go out on strike.
I was not there.
Okay.
And so, then Caesar asked us, you know, right away to try and get food to Delano. He needed gas money. We got some to him. I don't even remember how I did that. And then we would all just visit the picket line. You know, whenever I was in the valley, I would go to Delano and, you know, go on a picket line somewhere. Jim was there almost all the time. Dave was there pretty regularly. And we invited other people. Well, geez, like a week later, we had this delegation come down from... you know, church leaders delegation that included Bishop Sumner Walters from Stockton and Presbyterian minister from, maybe Robert McAfee Brown was on that one too. But anyway, it was like a dozen or so Protestant religious leaders came to Delano to see what was happening and then to make a pronouncement. And basically their pronouncement was, you know, there's a strike here and we hope that the two parties will get together and resolve it. Which is very moderate, but of course, the exact opposite of what the growers wanted to hear.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There was no strike from their point of view, and they certainly weren't about to get together with these upstart, you know, Mexicans and mm-hmm. talk about anything serious. Of course, in their minds, they had always been in control, and they were still in control. And, you know, the sheriff was with them, the local churches were with them, the county supervisors were with them. What did they need? But this church. It was annoying to their propaganda. I mean, always before they've been able to isolate a strike and just crush it right there. But here were people coming and saying there really was a strike. These really were local strikers. These weren't just a bunch of communists from Cuba, you know, and then going back home and telling their congregations. And slowly but surely, the growers began to realize that this was, you know, this was potentially a problem for them. And they probably hated the church involvement as much as they hated Caesar. Because lots of them were local church people too. And, yeah. And then they began to figure out that some of their church money was going to support the migrant ministry. Mm-hmm. And then that just drove them nuts. Just nuts. I mean, this local church where their kids were in Sunday school and learning how to be good, upstanding Christians was actually donating money to their denomination, the Methodist denomination, which eventually was giving it to church leaders, which are like trying to balance the ship, would write back and say, we just figured it out. Really, it's only like 0.10 mil of your local congregation's money that actually ends up going to the migrant ministry. And the growers write back and said, we don't care. If it's 0.001 mil, the connection is the same.
Yeah.
Stop it. And of course, what happened is every church, every Protestant, mainstream Protestant church in every valley eventually passed a resolution calling on their denomination to sever their relationship with the migrant ministry. Either sever relationship with the Council of Churches, period, or just with the migrant ministry, either one. And so that every denomination then had to go through this raging war for about 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. Not about justice for farm workers, not at first, but about whether the migrant ministry should be allowed to exist. Since we were taking sides in a labor dispute.
What happened to your personal life there in the first month or so of the strike? What kind of time were you spending in Delano or away?
It wasn't just Delano, it was everywhere.
Fundraising and...
Every time you turned around, every time I picked up the phone, or Sue, who was my associate in the office, picked up the phone, some group somewhere wanted to have a forum to debate or to discuss this issue. It took a little while for that to generate, right? That didn't happen right away in 65, but in 66 and 67, it was like... So I was constantly going into these settings, you know, where Alan Grant or some other local, some other grower or some grower's representative, you know, some high-powered grower representative from Berkeley or Davis or someplace, you know, would come down and we would debate. And the one I remember the most was like in the, it was probably the Presbyterian Church in Visalia, big church, or the Methodist Church, big church. And when Caesar and I, and Alan Grant, and then some professor on the other side, right? And
Grant is Farm Bureau, right?
Grant was Farm Bureau. The church was full, and there was like 300 or 400 people out on the lawn, and they had set up like a loudspeaker system. And when Caesar and I had to walk through this crowd, and he was like, I was probably in a state of shock, but Caesar was listening to everything. By the time we got the platform, he says, Chris, he says, they hate you worse than they hate me. And it was true, because these were church people, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. It was understandable. Yeah. He's this radical Mexican. What do you expect?
Yeah.
But this is one of our own, traitor. Same thing as a nigger lover, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, but that was happening everywhere. And boy, did I learn a lesson. I mean, I'm basically a kind of like a conciliator type person. I mean, I kind of understand Bill Clinton, you know, really well. I mean, it's a bad thing for a president, but I learned earlier than he did. I would go to these meetings, you know, and I would try to explain what we were doing in ways that people would understand. And the fact that 90% of them wanted to hang me, right? And then very quickly I learned that I was not there for them. There was nothing I could do or say that would help them. I was there for the 5% that were quietly supporting us, you know, with their prayers or with their contributions or with whatever, or even in some cases more than that, right? So that I had to provide them with the ammunition they needed locally to fight this good fight, because it was harder for them than it was for me.
But it took me a little while to realize that that was my job. And these other people were gonna feel the same way when I left as when I came in, except they might feel, oh, he's slick. That one's slick. Mm-hmm. You know, not that he has any truth on his side. He is slick. Yeah,
all the more reason to.
You gotta admit,
all the more reason
you gotta to. Gotta admit, yeah. He is really slick. Yeah.
All the more reason to get rid of him, right? Yeah.
But anyway, that was my life for a couple of years. It was just like holding the fort, interpreting what we were doing, making sure that our church friends were with us. And that's when we lost our valley support and we gained urban support. A lot more people wanted to support the migrant ministry because of our stance in Delano, who were, you know, at the same, also involved in supporting the civil rights movement.
And can you put a date on when did the urban support, well,
start growing?
Let me
be more
clear about this. Was there a connection to that and Chavez's fast, first long fast?
Which was 68, right? No, probably there was more of a connection to March in 66. But it wasn't really either event. It was just what it was the growing visibility of the struggle.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, in the life of the churches, there was probably more visibility than there was even in the press, mm-hmm. because of this internal controversy.
Uh-huh. So that debate was actually generating wider, was focusing attention nationwide, in effect, on you.
Of course, and Caesar and Fred knew right away, more controversy, better. Wonderful. I mean, I was like,
you're trying to conciliate, right?
To realize what a wonderful thing this was. But eventually, I realized that, you know, that, hey, I mean, this is good. Yeah. This is good for the cause. Well, the more people know about it.
Well, ultimately, what, about 71, there's a national migrant farm worker ministry, right? I mean, is this controversy basically generating the steam to get to that point?
Yeah,
or sometimes it's presented, well, you know, things got so bad as far as support in California that nation had to step in. No, that's not...
Our support grew. Mm-hmm. I mean, our financial base. Mm-hmm. I mean, not that we had more money, we had more to do.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And we were, by that time, we were supporting people full-time on subsistence working with the union on the boycott or in the fields. Mm-hmm. In 67, 68, we started the worker priest program, where we supported some people who worked in the fields and reported back, you know, what was going on.
Yeah.
And then eventually, as the boycott grew, we supported people working in the boycott. And our summer volunteers, mm-hmm. slowly but surely, we assigned them to the boycott somewhere, instead of, you know, to a labor camp somewhere. Mm-hmm. So that our needs grew, but our support also grew. And from national denominations for the worker priest program, we got national denominational support, even though we were at California Migrant Ministry. And then people from the urban areas, no doubt about it, they just they rallied around. They loved this thing that was happening in their own backyard. Yeah. And as church people, they were proud that this was happening. This was like one of the good things happening. As far as, you know, committed Christians were concerned. Well, of course, a lot of people didn't have that view, but this issue went to every single denomination, and in almost every case where the denomination was an urban-rural split, we carried the day. Where it was a San Joaquin Valley or an Imperial Valley, you know, denominational adjudicatory, like the San Joaquin Presbytery of the Presbyterian Church or the San Joaquin Diocese of the Episcopal Church, we weren't even invited to talk. I mean, you know, like that was a foregone conclusion. We were, you know, the vote was that we should be out of there, stay out of there. So anyway, but in the urban areas, it was a tough, tough battle because the rural folks were so determined, right? It was their fight. They knew more about it. It was their livelihood. And so they were determined. But as determined as they were, they couldn't.
Because they're tremendous agribusiness links with the valley and the cities. I mean, you just...
Yeah, but not in numbers.
Not in numbers?
Not in numbers. Yeah. Unfortunately, the institution wasn't really well-financed by agribusiness. So the the urban judicatories, you know, really were dealing with, you know, the votes, mm-hmm. the votes, and the urban churches were more plentiful. Well, there were more of them, and they had more delegates, and they carried the day. Mm-hmm. And they tried, of course, our opponents tried to keep the issue from being something other than justice for farm workers. I mean, if we could keep the issue on justice for farm workers and the churches need to be there supporting justice for farm workers, we could win. Yeah. They wanted it to be, they found beer cans in the back of Jim Drake's pickup truck, you know, or they wanted it to be something diversionary.
Sure.
And but when it went, the church has a real hard time saying no when you get them to, when you force them to vote on the issue of justice. Mm-hmm. They can get, there can be some sort of like a, what's the parliamentary procedure, mm-hmm. or some maneuver, you know, to get it delayed or off to a committee or make the issue something else, fine. But when the issue is finally forced to being that, then and we usually won the vote. But it was time consuming. It was exhausting. It was just like, and some of it was discouraging. I mean, my own presbytery, it was, you know, which was L.A. Presbytery. You know, Gallon Grant came down, he and I debated, but that was support the grape boycott. That was not, should the migrant ministry survive or not. That was support the grape boycott. And we lost by about 3 votes.
Yeah.
I had ministers coming up to me afterwards. Said, we're really with you, Chris.
Yes, after the vote.
And I knew those were the ones who were with me in spirit, but they voted the other way.
The other way, right. Well, they had to represent their constituents.
And they were worried. They were worried that this controversy would cost them membership.
Yeah.
That's they didn't vote on their conviction. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, with the ordaining homosexuals, it's not the issue. The issue is that the church will be split and we'll lose members.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The worker priest was that consciously modeled on the French worker priest?
Consciously.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It sounds like you made it work. Where in France, I guess the hierarchical structure didn't...
Well, in our case, it didn't last long enough to be tested.
Oh, so it wasn't, yeah.
I mean, it was like in the fields for a while, but then eventually it was in the boycott. Mm-hmm. And in the boycott it worked. Yeah. By the way, that's what in response to what you said, Jorge, the issue became national, mm-hmm. partly because there was national coverage, but mostly because the boycott. Okay. The boycott went to every city mm-hmm. in the country. And people used to think what a great organizing job we did getting all these churches involved all over the country. It was really the boycotters. You know, the local boycotters in Cleveland.
Yeah.
They would go to the churches in Cleveland. Sure. And there they were. They'd come all this way from Delano, California. They'd been farm workers all their lives. And this is their story. Now, what's the guy going to do?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then he may want to check up on things. So we use the migrant ministry as sort of like his sort of like, check on the truth. Naturally, we would tell him the truth. Since we were another church organization, right? So we provided resources, chronologies, background material. We helped them think through their strategy, but it was really from the initiative of the workers that got them first involved. We never could have involved all those.
There are 40-plus documents I've seen references to that apparently migrant ministry was producing and disseminating. Was this in that
context? It's a minor collection, I'm sure. Yeah, all the time.
Yeah.
We're all the time writing these.
Well, when you say
there's a new struggle to develop, we would write like a history of that struggle.
That's not such a minor collection. Where are they? We'd where like to they? See those. Where are they? We see
Wayne State. Okay. Yeah. No, there's lots and lots and lots of them.
Yeah.
And see, another thing. Yeah. You get me started, I'll never stop. The other thing was that the church couldn't deny us. We were a child of the church, created by the denominations, right, for this work. And they knew us. And they had gotten to know us through these non-controversial years. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So they couldn't just, they would not accept the fact that we were a bunch of crazy, you know, radicals, just down there to make trouble. We enjoyed trouble. We enjoyed calling people names. We enjoyed making mischief. That was the way we were. That was what they were trying to be. Mm-hmm. But they knew that. They knew Chris Harmer. They knew Jim Drake. We'd worked with us for years. They knew we weren't like that. So that history of working with the churches and the denominations and the councils of churches in the non-controversial period just, you know, strengthened our hand.
Mm-hmm.
when it came, it's like loaves and fishes. Mm-hmm. We feed hungry people. And now when we start fighting for housing, you know, for the, and the city doesn't want to do it, they can't just write us off as people who don't know nothing. Yeah. We know.
Yet they want to keep you down here in an old industrial area because you're actually better than what was here before.
They don't want us to expand this industrial area. Oh,
okay, so you've got problems there, huh?
They're going to learn.
Yeah.
A hard lesson.
I like it.